Today, on the final episode of the Colorado Review podcast, author Ariel Katz will read from her story, Disaster Management. Then, host Lilia Schrafer will join her to discuss things further. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
I'll just go ahead and read from the beginning, if that sounds good.
That's great.
Okay. Great. So this is from the beginning of Disaster Management. On a Thursday evening, the year Caleb and I were in San Francisco, just out of college, only just starting to fall out of love, an old woman stopped us in the discount supermarket on Geary. She looked like I imagined my great-grandmother might have, a Russian babushka type, except instead of a headscarf, she was wearing some sort of floppy fisherman's hat studded with fake flies and hooks. We were by the cantaloupes. Caleb was lifting them to see which was ripest, and I was holding the basket, not really looking at him, staring into space, exhausted from work, supposedly. And suddenly there was this woman, 5 feet tall, laugh lines hyper-visible in the store's greenish warehouse fluorescence. She was wearing a pink zip-up jacket that said Girls Trip 2005 Wolf Creek Ranch. It fit her well. I hoped it was from a granddaughter or something, but probably it was from the Salvation Army next door. She was looking back at me. She laid a hand in the crook of Caleb's arm and said, calm, smiling, your wife is going to murder you. Caleb, holding a melon aloft, glanced at me. Well, he said after a moment, sure hope not. The woman flicked lint off her pink jacket, frowning in concentration. You know what I'm thinking? You know what I am thinking in my head right now? Caleb shrugged. I turned towards the handwritten neon orange sign advertising a sale on avocados. Half of them were moldy, but some were okay. That was the trade-off with this place. Cheap produce, but sometimes you cut the apples open and they were brown at the core. I'm thinking in my head right now that you, she jabbed a finger at Caleb's chest, and her, she jerked her bristled chin in the direction of the register, where a young woman with red streaked hair was ringing up about 30 artichokes for a hunched over guy in a trench coat, are going to be having sex tonight. Caleb put the melon he'd chosen in my basket, weighing it down. In that case, I'll make it till tonight at least. I moved towards the onions. The guy at the register was putting artichoke after artichoke into the pockets of his trench coat. Should I keep going or? Oh, okay.
That was awesome. I think that's a really good place to stop, actually. You have such a gift for dropping a reader into a scene very, very quickly and getting it moving very, very quickly. And I wonder, it just occurred to me, if this might be some kind of New York like quirk or habit that happens to us as writers.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting because I grew up in North Carolina and then I was living in San Francisco before my MFA, where I was in Iowa. And so yeah, I wonder if some of that is from like my time living in San Francisco too, of like things happening very fast and circumstances changing quickly because you're around a lot of different unpredictable people who might change the course of your day briefly or in a minor way.
That's so true. Like I grew up in New York and it's the reverse. Like I now am in Colorado for grad school and I finally know how to slowly pace a novel. I mean, I think I do because I finally learned how to slow down myself. I think about that all the time. This will be no surprise to the people listening, but I really caught on to so many of the kind of nostalgic references towards Eliza, the narrator and our protagonist, her Russian Jewish heritage. And so I found myself seeing Eliza more and more as an artist in exile in some way. And I feel this work puts that in conversation with her Jewish background. It's interesting that the narrator admits to wanting to move around a lot in order to forget she's from anywhere, but she ironically ends up working at a place selling rugula. And the old woman that you just, that just turned up in that excerpt you read, reminds her of an image of her babushka. or her imagined babushka if she never met her. So there seems to be Jewish concerns of nostalgia happening underneath. And as a Jewish writer myself, I'm wondering if that tends to happen in your work, or even if it's just true in your life in general.
Yeah, I mean, that's such an interesting question. And I'm so grateful that you were sort of picking up on those things as you were reading, because I don't typically think of this story necessarily as like one of my stories that most engages with sort of Jewish themes or my sort of interest in Jewishness. But yeah, I would say, you know, my mother and her parents immigrated from Romania in the 70s, and they're Romanian Jews. And then my paternal grandparents were German Jews and Holocaust survivors. And so I think, you know, for me in my work, I'm often interested in memory and, you know, the ways that memory and history affect characters' lives in the present in both these sort of conscious and unconscious ways. Yeah. And I think, you know, just growing up hearing stories from particularly my grandparents' generation, but also my parents' generation, I think continues to like inflect my life and my writing. And I feel like there's this simultaneous impulse to like honor and to tell those histories, and also to sort of just like move on and be, you know, quote unquote American, or to sort of focus on the future. And yeah, so I think I've always been interested in that tension between characters who might want to go out and explore and be their own person and sort of not spend so much time looking back, and but still maybe in spite of themselves being drawn back to these foundational stories and aspects of identity. Yeah, I think the term nostalgia is really interesting though, and I wondered like what you sort of have in mind with that term.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's definitely nostalgia with an asterisk at the end, because, you know, we get that scene at the end where Eliza's on the phone with her mother, and it's this phone conversation where her mom is just, she's just totally unloading. And Eliza has a very keen sense of her mom's sense of artistic failure. And you do it so interestingly, because you don't just say like her mother has failed as a painter. It's the fact that she was so good as a in the home, you know, as the traditional domestic role a woman would play, which is fascinating. I feel like it's a nostalgia where she does say she wants to go home. She doesn't know where she's really going in life. But at the same time, what she's returning to is this kind of, that it feels to me like that source of what drives her to feel like she's not doing enough artistically herself. Mm-hmm. So she's like nostalgia for the comfort and familiarity of home, but that same home and what she's inherited from her mom, I feel is not healthy for her. And she knows that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm quite interested in that idea of like the domestic as a very comforting space and familiar space, and one that sort of engenders nostalgia, and then, you know, one that can simultaneously be stifling and stifling particularly to like a woman artist, or but also a great source of sort of strength and grounding. And so yeah, I think it's something, I don't know, and I don't know if it's particular to like Jewishness, but I think it's definitely particular to being young in some ways too, of like struggling with a relationship to home and to domestic comfort or to domesticity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you asked about nostalgia, and I realized you might've even meant more sort of what the original question was referring to, the sort of, there's like little, they just sort of bubble up, like these little moments where I sense that kind of, I don't know, like you said, if it's particularly Jewish, but sort of a nostalgia for the past, mm-hmm. for culture. And I feel like that's been particularly acute with our generation. I'm saying our generation, but I'm assuming we're both millennials. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going trickling into Gen Z as well, in different ways. But certainly, like, I can relate because, you know, if I write about a lot of fraught relationships between mother and daughter, and when I'm writing, it's like there's these really these cruelties and these sort of really intense frictions that pop up between them. But it's always that sort of nostalgia for the past that ends up being a place where they can meet in the middle, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think, yeah, and the ways in which that nostalgia might be a little divorced from like the actual reality of a family's history and
right,
or the ways that yeah, because I think something that I think about in my own family is that there were a lot of these like very traumatic memories in sort of the, you know, the generation that went through the Holocaust and through World War II and all of that stuff, and through, you know, communism in the case of my Romanian grandparents, and how those memories were sort of suppressed and not told as much to, you know, my parents' generation, but are maybe told more openly to millennials, because it's like now it feels like a safe time to, or a safer time to tell those stories, or, you know, people are older and they sort of, yeah, I'm rambling now, but yeah, just sort of, that idea of different histories like unfurling at different times. And like, I don't really know what this has to do with nostalgia, but sort of maybe that too, as a site of like places where families connect or sort of come to consensus around like history or memory, in addition to, you know, like foods that you might feel nostalgic about or something like that.
That's no, I understand what you're saying, and you weren't rambling, you were unfurling.
There we go. Yeah, I'll take it.
No, it's fascinating. So maybe because we're both unfurling, and we can go a little bit more into the mechanics of the story, because I was so struck by a lot of what was happening on a craft level. And so I just your dialogue is I've never quite encountered dialogue quite like that, where it captures it definitely captures for me the way people our age talk, in the sense that I don't know that traditional literary fiction always really captures how people speak. It always feels like slightly something happens to it. And I understand the craft reasons why writers do that, but yours, it captures so much subtlety and overt cruelty between these characters at the same time. And it was fascinating. So I was just wondering if you could talk about your process with dialogue. Does it just sort of come to you, or are you someone who actually, I remember I had a creative writing exercise in undergrad where they made me like record people in Panera Bread.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh?
Yeah. It didn't have to be Panera Bread, but I like bread. It's so I was there, and, you know, and I bet there's other ways people craft dialogue. Yeah. Do you have anything to say on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't do a ton of like transcribing dialogue from real life, but I do think that there are moments when, you know, I'll be out and about and I'll hear just a great line, or I'll overhear a great line, or, you know, I'll be in conversation and something that someone says really strikes me. And often that can serve as like a kernel or like a fulcrum of an imagined and fictional conversation. And so, but I think, yeah, so I think I'll often start with maybe there's a line that comes from something that I've observed, but that then the conversation that's built around it, I build it more using like just sort of deeply inhabiting the characters and the rhythm of the conversation and sort of what each feels about the other. I did have a teacher during my MFA who really harped on like the importance of what's unsaid in addition to what's spoken aloud. And so like, I definitely try to keep that in mind too. Like if characters are talking about something trivial or something minor, but really what they're talking about are like the big unspoken things in their relationship. Like that I think is something that is important to me while I'm writing dialogue. And I think for this story, I was particularly thinking about that at the end of the story when the two main characters, Caleb and Eliza, are sort of debating photographers and art, and they're sort of using this, you know, more rarefied language or something because it's sort of less charged between them and they're speaking to each other in this currency that maybe feels safer, but they're talking about each other in the relationship still, even if they're not talking about that directly. So I think, yeah, and when I'm reading dialogue, that's often, I do like a good confrontation in dialogue. I think sometimes, you know, I don't love dialogue that veers too much into like talking about trivial things and leaving a lot unsaid, because I think, you know, when I observe people talking, it's sometimes like that, but sometimes more confrontational. So yeah, I'd say a mix between those two techniques, maybe.
That's fascinating, because right when you said that, I was reminded of, I feel like the craft advice about anything that I hear the most often is dialogue needs to do more than one thing.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's a James Woods, oh my gosh, am I adding an S to his name? James Wood, right?
I think it's just James Jesus. Wood.
I hope the co-host keeps this. okay, so anyway, you know, we know who we're talking about.
Yes.
And I generally, I mean, I agree, and I feel like I do that when I'm writing. But at the same time, just like what you were saying with the subtlety, like we're not all that clever in real life. You know, like I feel like we're just too but that's why, I guess that's why it's art and not real life. But your dialogue too has so many registers, because there's that scene when Caleb and Eliza are on the hike, and they're having this whole fight about why didn't one of them remember to bring sandwiches in the heat, but it's not about the sandwiches, it's about so much more. And I just love that image of the beautiful naked couple walking by. And as soon as they walk by, Eliza changes her tone. And she's like, did you remember to bring sunscreen? Like, to perform being caring? Is that what you intended there? Or am I overanalyzing that?
I think, yeah, I saw the couple as sort of this contrast to them, because the, you know, this beautiful couple is just sort of out, you know, being at ease and having this day that they're not really having, but that maybe they wish that they were. Yeah. So I definitely saw that couple as like a contrast to the two of them. And also, you know, I think, and maybe this has to do with it being sort of a young couple, but in that moment with Eliza, I was sort of envisioning that she, you know, it's a little bit of like projection that she's much better at imagining like what he might need, or, you know, thinking about someone else than she is, you know, thinking about herself and her own needs. And, you know, cause I think there's a line later on where she realizes that she's actually the one burning in the sun, even though she's sort of offering the sunscreen to him. So yeah, I think it's sort of a moment of like youngness for both of them, and being just not quite knowing where the boundaries between themselves and this other person are yet, maybe. Yeah, but I think, yeah, that's what I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, it says she's 22 in this. I presume he's the same age or close, so.
Yeah, that's what I envisioned.
You're like, I know, like 22, you're like on the cusp of, like, blatant lack of self-awareness and profound moments of introspection. I feel like your life just oscillates between those things. And yeah, you capture that really well.
Thank you.
So kind of segueing from the dialogue, I did mention how struck I was by how, I don't want to say cruel, I said cruel earlier, but how it's so, they really, I'm going to say they penetrate each other. I don't mean sexually. I mean, they're kind of way that they're both, it almost reads as, it's like an awareness that each one has sold their soul, so to speak, or the way that's how they see it at their age and from their frame of reference. And when they go there in the dialogue, it gets very, it's like I forget that these people are in a relationship or they're in love or they've forgotten in that moment. It's very powerful. And so to me, this was a story about two people. We're told right from the beginning that they're falling out of love or have fallen out of love. But to me, it's also a story about how what the world does to artists or people who choose that path. I just feel like it can create such conditions of lovelessness for the self and for others. Was that what you had in mind when you were writing? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think the idea of them each like getting into the same argument in different forms is like they're never getting at the issue directly. And it's sort of because the issue between them is not like due to their individual faults or individual relationship necessarily. It's sort of because, yeah, they're each trying to learn how to just be a person in the world and how to balance this thing of like trying to live authentically as an artist, but also to like survive in this very punishingly expensive city, San Francisco, in, you know, I envisioned the story happening in the recent past or, you know, pre-pandemic present. So I guess, yeah, I'm just thinking for a second. And maybe going back to some of the notes that I.
So you're totally fine. You take your time. You're doing awesome, by the way. This is a great conversation.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm enjoying it too. This is, you know, one of the first opportunities I've had to like talk with someone who's read this story so closely. So I feel very grateful.
Sometimes I talk with writers though, and they, I think they're almost like not put off, but like they're like not prepared for how close I read it. And it's almost like, it can be a little, so sometimes I feel like I should like ask writers what kind of conversation they prefer to have too. Cause it's like, do you want to go in depth on little mechanical things or do you want to talk mostly writing life, you know? So yeah, it's funny, but anyway.
Yeah, no, I feel like it's great because, you know, I've read this story like 27 million times. And so it's like, oh, I get to talk with someone who's like read it. Yeah. Almost as much, I mean, like second to how much I've read it.
Divided by nine. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess, okay. So to answer that question, like, I think, you know, it's a question that I have thought about a lot, like as someone who is trying to write, of like, how do I write and also kind of exist within this capitalist framework that demands a lot of time, and like how do I find stability as a young writer, and is stability entirely desirable, and how do you, you know, how long do you keep going before you give up, which is a kind of depressing question. But you know, at the end of the story, Eliza sort of does move on to something different in her life, and Caleb sort of ends up, you know, doing art over a longer period of time. And I think with both of them, I guess something that I thought about as I was thinking back on the story before this interview is that, like, I think a lot of artists experience kind of this ebb and flow over the course of a life and career of like success and money and self-confidence. And for most people, there's like a lot of ebb at the beginning, and dealing with that can make you kind of bitter or disaffected or, you know, kind of turn on other artists. And I think that's a little bit of what's happening between Caleb and Eliza, is they're both trying to make it work, but they don't really know how, and they don't really know how to support one another in that pursuit. And there are a lot of these sort of outside forces that are making it really difficult for them, but maybe they are sort of turning the blame on themselves and each other more than sort of, you know, these external forces that make it hard to be a young artist in our country and world. And so I also think one thing I was thinking about as well is like, I wrote the story in 2019 and I've become more interested in this question, like during the pandemic and just with, you know, everything that's been going on in our world in the past couple of years since I wrote the story. But I do think that like, there's an interesting question of like how to make art as the world is ending and, or, you know, as there's all this stuff going on in the world where it feels like, you know, every day is a new terrible news event or environmental event. And one of the backdrops to the story is sort of wildfires and flooding and these other environmental threats. And Eliza ends up getting this like disaster management degree, which is sort of dealing with environmental threats and destruction. And so I feel like there's this additional layer of like, what does the world do to an artist, or how does the world, how do artists exist in the world, you know, in the face of sort of environmental destruction and, you know, all the sort of war and atrocity that is happening in our present moment.
That's fascinating. I feel like and you just got at the complexity of it, because I feel like I'll hear that, or I've even found myself saying such a thing like, my art is futile because XYZ, or it's like a nagging, I won't even hear it articulated verbally in my head, but it's like a nagging like feeling that you just get every time you read the news. And then on the other hand, I'll hear a response of like, oh, we'll make art because the world's ending. And I feel like it just becomes a play on language. I think it's so much more complicated than that. And the questions you're asking about how does artistic, not just function, but identity within artists, how does that change when literally the world as the context for the art is just changing so, so, so rapidly? And you do that in a, like you set us up in the story too, that we're in a grocery store. There's something domestic about it, and it just expands. Can I ask, did you always know if you would give that sort of jump in time in the story?
I don't think I knew it when I started the story. I have been told in the past that I do a lot of jumps in time, and that's possibly because, particularly during the years that I was like working on this story, I was reading a lot of Alice Munro, and she is like a master of that form of jumping in time. And I was particularly, I think at the time I was reading a story of hers, I think it's called Axis. It was like in the New Yorker, I think. Anyway, it has sort of this geologic time in addition to the human time. And I think I was very like taken with that. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I don't think I knew at first that I was going to make a jump in time, but it doesn't surprise me that I did based on what I was reading at the time and my own sensibilities.
I was just going to say, reading Alice Munro will do that, I think. I had to read, I didn't have to read, but I had to pick a story to like show the class one day. And have you read, I'm assuming you've read Runaway, or is it Runaways?
Yeah, I've definitely read at least 2/3 of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. It's like repetition now. It's the same as the James Woods. Okay. It's either Runaways, her wonderful collection. And there's a story, Trespasses. It's like two parts and it's huge and long. And there's all these jumps in time. And I remember after I read that story, I was convinced that my thesis was going to be this science fiction novel taking place in the year 3000. So maybe I had a more extreme reaction.
Yeah, that would be a big jump in time, but I would be there for it. That sounds cool.
Oh my God, that's so funny. So I'm interested in, like, I just noticed visually how much was happening with, like, what's in quotes. And I noticed that there were these phrases that the narrator uses, like she wants to have the ruthlessness or the edge that her mother never had as an artist, and she wants to make it. And it's almost kind of meta, as though the writer is kind of putting Eliza's, the narratives that she's telling herself, in this kind of container. And it signaled to me as a reader, like, yeah, these are the kinds of narratives that she's internalized, that she thinks that she has to, or a standard that she has to reach. Did you think of it that way at all? And if not, can you just talk about what can go into making I feel like a lot of writing explores the artist identity, but you do it in such a fresh, unique way, and how to make something like that fresh and specific.
That's a many layered question.
I know, I'm sorry.
I think one thing, like during my MFA, I feel like there was a quotation from Jenny Offel's book, Department of Speculation, that got sort of tossed around. And I love that book. I think it's wonderful. But her line about sort of the art monster, and, you know, that she was young and she wanted to be an art monster and she was never going to get married. And I just remember sort of during my MFA years talking a lot about that line with friends, and just this idea of like a fear of there being a dichotomy or an opposition between like an artist's life and family life. And I think that's something that for me personally has always been like a preoccupation, and has, you know, I think is something that is sort of a false dichotomy or opposition, but that, you know, in the story, that's a narrative that almost gives Eliza the sense that she maybe has more control over her trajectory than she actually does, because she has this way of explaining how things have gone for her mother, and that if she can just avoid that, things can be different for herself. But in reality, that sort of overlooks that, you know, a lot of recognition or success in an artist's life is ultimately outside of their control. And that the ways of like making it, quote unquote, are pretty vast and various and can look really different for different people. And so I think, I guess I was just interested in that dichotomy or opposition, and how the idea of it can be really powerful and a little scary and have definitely some truth to it, but that also in thinking about the domestic and like the artist's life as so dichotomous, that all, like, it becomes a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy for Eliza, because she feels like she has to make this choice between one and the other, and maybe that's not as much of a, you know, either or as she imagines that it is. I guess, and I just, in terms of the quotations, I feel like that's a tic of mine. Like, I do that sort of in conversation too, maybe giving a word a little bit of like a wink that I'm not entirely serious or something like that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I love that you just called the quotations like winks. I'm going to use that actually. Oh my gosh. I'm teaching creative writing next semester. That's not, yes, 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 I agree. So, and I love too that you mentioned Department of Speculation. That line also is like the one line I remember. Not saying you don't remember more, but I remember like one line from that book and it was that line. Yeah. Something about
it. Yeah, it's a very striking line. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And the people who read her book are probably, we're probably more likely to be art monsters. So maybe. I enjoyed your story so much. I just want to read everything you write. Is there anything you're working on right now that you care to divulge?
Yeah. I'm working on two main longer projects. And the first one is about a family of Romanian Jewish immigrants and their descendants sort of convening at the family home in Queens for a final time. And as they clear out the house, old secrets arise between the family members. It's set in Forest Hills in Queens. And I'm also working on a collection of short stories that sort of, I'd say, and I'm hoping that this story will sort of be in that collection. And the stories deal with some similar themes as this story, I think, like isolation and art making and relationships between young people. So that's what I've been working on mostly.
That's super exciting. It's 1:45. I think we talked about a lot. And I don't want to be, I want to be respectful of your time. So I think we're all set.
Great.
I'm just so happy. I feel like this went really well. And like, you are very composed and I'm.
No, I feel the opposite. I feel like you're composed and I'm like rambling.
That's hysterical.
Yeah.
No, I'm like 90% sure it's the other way around, but I appreciate that very much.
This podcast was recorded in June via video conference and edited with the help of C. Culbertson and Alec Woodhone. This has been the final episode of the Colorado Review podcast. But keep your eyes peeled for interviews, readings, and other audio content in the future. We hope you've enjoyed this project and want to thank our listeners for their support. Goodbye.